She's been called the Mary Poppins of customer experience for her ability to transform companies into customer-centric powerhouses. With over 25 years in the CX/UX field, Debbie Leavitt has led the evolution from focusing purely on usability to understanding how human-centered design directly impacts business success. Her consulting firm, Delta CX, cuts waste by routing discoveries in validated user research. In our episode today, Debbie shares her journey to becoming an internationally recognized CX thought leader, and you'll hear how she builds high-performing teams centered around the customer experience. Debbie also weighs in on the hot debate sparked by Judd Anton's article, "The UX Research Reckoning is Here," with her take on focus, value, and the future of UX research. Now, let's join the conversation with Debbie. Debbie, could you share your journey that led you to become the Mary Poppins of customer experience and user experience?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working for many, many years in strategy, customer experience, user experience, research, information architecture and interaction design. And I just found about 10 or so years ago that I was doing a lot of consulting projects and freelance projects. And sometimes when I would leave for the day or for the project, people would go, "Bye, Mary Poppins." And I said, you know, I think there's something in that. And so, you know, I think the reason why that name kind of works is because I didn't just give it to myself. It was really something that people were calling me because that's how they saw me. And so I like to say I fly in, fix everything I can, sing a few songs, and then have to fly away to somewhere else. So the journey was just many, many years of doing the work.
Wow. And can you give me some background on that journey? How did you start? How was your entry into this industry? What prompted it? You know, was it like some desire that you had as a kid growing up, or was it like formative years in college? Like, how did you get into this industry?
Yeah. I was the kid who everybody assumed was going to become a psychologist or a lawyer. I was always the person trying to help someone who needed help and understand situations and solve problems. And so it was like, will she be a psychologist or a lawyer? And I like to joke, I've ended up both because there's so much of both of those in strategy and customer and user experiences. And so the journey really started in the mid 90s when I started a small company that was aimed at creating websites and helping small businesses with their strategy and their marketing and their online presence back when the web felt and was pretty new. So the journey really started there.
And how has your approach to transforming companies and teams evolved over the years?
Oh my gosh. Well, it's not so much the approach changes because I'm a play to my audience person as a musician. And so you can't go into the same company and just always sing the same song or do the same thing. You know, some people want to hear disco and some want to hear heavy metal and some want to hear both. And so ultimately, my approach is somewhat the same in that I'm kind of a change agent and I really want to investigate what's going on in a company and look for small wins and big wins and quick fixes and long-term fixes. But every company is different because they're all different sizes. They're all at different stages of different growth and some are more stuck in the mud than others. So I think it's really not about, oh, my approach has to change. It's more that my approach is fluid anyway, and I just have to, you know, take all the right tools out of the toolbox and sing the right song for that company and figure out what do I need to do to be most effective and to create some of that change.
You've emphasized cutting waste and guesses and assumptions. Can you elaborate on how you achieve this in practice?
Yeah, so there's a lot of companies that right now think that going with guesses and assumptions and hypotheses is fast and it makes us fast. Some will even say innovative. And then I say, cool, what did you innovate? And then it's cricket. You know, we didn't innovate anything. But a lot of this can be wasteful. And we see that waste when, first of all, we look at our outcomes. Were customers happy? Were they delighted? Did this go well at all? Did we achieve any of our results? And so where we didn't achieve results or where things didn't go that well, then that's clearly something that was risk that came to be. It was wasteful because it probably didn't have to end up that way. And those of you who've been on these teams usually saw this coming, right? How often have we said, I don't think this is a good idea. I don't think this is going to work out. And someone says, no, my idea is freaking awesome. We're going to do it. And we'll just find out later where we need to iterate. But sometimes iteration's not enough. Sometimes an idea stinks no matter how much you iterate. So these are all possibilities for risk and waste. And that ultimately guessing can be slower and more expensive. It can also compromise the morale of our teams, where now we're fighting over who's got the best idea because we don't really know, because we didn't understand the customer that well. So we're just going to go with this idea or this guess. Should we go with mine or yours? Or whatever. And we have all of these internal issues that manifest as these external issues with our companies. And so I think that we have to get back to the basics. And the basics of both agile and lean are, let's be more efficient. Efficient doesn't always mean go as fast as you can until everyone burns out. Efficient is that balance. I think I have a graphic I like to roll out during my YouTube shows. Let's see, we're on video today, so I can roll it out. I talk about efficiency being a balance between, okay, how fast can we go reasonably so with balancing the customer's needs and making sure we're cutting that risk and waste? Because sure, all of this is in service of the business goal. We have to be satisfying at least some of our business goals or things fall apart. But, you know, being a musician, I like to joke that that's the tonic pedal. It's the note that keeps playing that's underneath everything. It's the cloud hanging over us. But we're not doing enough to say, you know what, that's a risky decision. That's a wasteful decision. That didn't turn out well last time. Why are we doing it again? And to try to make ourselves better along the way. But it's tough. It's tough, especially when there are egos.
I love that, and thank you so much for the graphic. With your extensive experience since 1995 in various projects or various aspects of user experience, which project or which product would you say has been the most transformative for you, and tell us why?
Yeah, obviously, over many years, there's a lot of interesting things that I've worked on, but I feel like the most interesting project we've done was really about a year ago, and we had a startup come to us, and they were a funded startup, funded with a company that I can't name, but wow. And they had some money, I don't know how much, and they had already had some user research in air quotes done by, I think, some sort of branding or visual design company, and they didn't know what to do with the information they got. It was just a fire hose of information. And luckily, someone recommended us. And ultimately, what they wanted from us was everything. They said, we don't have product market fit. We're not even sure what we should be building. We think maybe we should go in this direction. We think maybe we should go in this direction. We don't really know. And so we did a research project, mostly interview, some observational, with about, I think it ended up being 35 people from their target audience. And we delivered to them not just the research insights and some actionable suggestions from the research, but we also delivered to them a business model. We delivered to them an ecosystem model where these are how different types of customers and partners and other players will fit into your business. We delivered problem statements, a list of problem statements that they could solve however they like, but we also gave them some of our high-level solutions. We turned those into a high-level feature roadmap with what we thought should be their prioritization. And we did all this in 6 weeks. And for some people, they say, well, 6 weeks, that's not agile. Come on, it's three sprints. Everybody has spent three sprints on something. And so it's not the wildest amount of time ever. It's not like big consulting company X coming in and taking a year to do something. This was all done in, you know, we had preliminary information to them in 4 weeks and the final stuff in 6. And it was also relatively inexpensive as well. And so I'm really proud of that one because I think it really showcases that arc of how people sometimes isolate research or they isolate product strategy, and they don't always bridge these, and they don't always bridge the problem finding and the problem solving. So I'm kind of most excited about that one, because we've really got to showcase a lot of our talents and skills at Delta CX to do that for a startup who luckily was self-aware enough to say, uh-oh, you know, we're struggling here. We're not totally sure who we should be when we grow up.
So speaking about companies struggling as well, let's change gears here a bit. As a strategist, what key factors do you consider when building or improving CX or UX teams?
Yeah, so you have to consider so many things. Like, again, I don't just come in and go, this is Debbie's approach. Behold, you know, behold, everyone, the, you know, the fire has come down from the mountains, and this is what the Lord has said. It's really about understanding people are, and I usually start by investigating the business internally. Let's talk to some leaders and executives, depending upon the size, and let's talk to some of the people doing the work, you know, even at some of those lower levels, junior, mid-level, senior developers, product managers, UX people, marketers, data and analysts, and figure out what's going on here. What is this company doing well? What are we doing badly? How are our results? Where could our results be better? Where have we made some great decisions? Where have we made some decisions that came back later and bit us in the butt? What have we been doing with staffing and hiring? Where are we allocating these resources? And where has that worked and where hasn't it? So first, like any change management approach, we have to kind of first get that lay of the land to understand what's going on here and what's broken? And is there anything that's working really well that we shouldn't change or that we should enhance or do more of? And so I would say that from a strategic perspective, we have to start with that. And then we can come up with a strategic plan of what do we think we should change in what order, because that matters too. Because one of the things that I teach to other change agents is what I like to call my change dependencies map, which is sometimes a change you want to make is blocked by something else. And then that could be blocked by something else. And if we don't start removing some of the blockers for the change, we're not going to get a lot done. And the example I normally give is many companies tend to think, oh, we want to be better or faster or do this. Let's just hire a trainer. Let's just all get some training. But very rarely do they empower people to actually start doing things differently. So everybody's learned this other way or this new technique or whatever it might be, but no one's allowed to take more time to try it out. No one's allowed to change maybe how a team is staffed to try it out. No one knows how to measure if it's working or not. We absolutely haven't empowered people to try this. But yet, what are we saying? We're so innovative. We're experimental. But then we're not even experimenting with our own efficiency and internal improvements. And so, you know, there's so many pieces that go into trying to create even small change at companies.
You're also an author, and you've authored books that aimed at integrating UX into software development. What inspired you to write these books, and what key message do you hope that readers take away?
Yeah, each book has been different. So the first book, which again is old and you don't have to go out, run out and read, but it was aimed at being a companion book to a workshop I was doing at the time where I was trying to teach engineers and agilists and scrum masters and all the people from that universe. What is UX and why do we need these people and how do we work with them better? And so I thought, oh, that needs a little companion book. So that was kind of the goal of that. I think that book could use some updating, but some people who read it found it helpful at the time, and that's cool. My second book was called Delta CX. It's way too long. You know, read it at your own risk. I stand by what I said, but I know I overwrote it a bit. It's too long. It's that or Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. They're equally long. So the goal of Delta CX was to reach kind of the CX and UX workers and leaders and say, you know, look, there's some problems in our industry and we're up against a lot of stuff. And let's take a look at how we got here and how we get out of this. Then the new book, which I released about a year ago, is called Customers Know You Suck. And this one was really written for everybody. I basically imagine the person reading it might not even know much at all about CX or UX, or maybe hasn't cared in the past. Maybe they're engineers or product managers or marketers or other people who, yeah, we know we have to satisfy customers and win them over, but they haven't thought too much about how we're going to get there, other than maybe we can make them do some stuff. So the book goes into more detail about look all around you. It sucks. There's so much garbage. There's so many crappy websites and crappy apps and terrible services and customer service people we shouldn't need and then we hate dealing with. Everything is so broken. And we know that and feel that as the customer and user, but then we show up to our jobs and continue these cycles of mediocrity. The mediocrity that we hate getting as a customer, we deliver to people and we act like, why aren't they kissing our boots? And so customers know you suck is kind of that wake-up call to people who'd like to create some change in their organization, aren't sure how we got here, aren't sure how to fix it, aren't sure how to stand up for doing things differently. And so that's got a much broader audience. And I call it kind of the customer experience, customer centricity audience.
Speaking about writing, there has been an article making rounds in the UX community titled "The UX Reckoning Is Here," by Judd Anton. The article suggests a significant shift in the UX research landscape. How do you perceive these changes in context of your own experiences?
Yeah, I think now I happened to disagree nearly completely with that article, and I read it today because I knew I was talking to you, and I took just a few notes on that, and so I certainly have thoughts. But if we have to take a look at how research has changed, I would say research has been devalued over time. That once upon a time, companies had R&D departments. You had entire departments of people who were technologists and scientists and researchers and all kinds of different experts coming together to make sure we understood target users and what do they need now and what kind of future could we create so that we're ahead of the game, we're beating our competitors, maybe even innovating or inventing. So companies had that, and the biggest ones still do. Apple certainly has an R&D department. Samsung, Disney has their Imagineers. So R&D is out there, but most companies fired R&D some years ago, thinking, "Oh, this is too slow. We don't want innovation to take, whatever time it takes." And you're forgetting that everyone loves their iPhone, but the iPhone is really changed. It evolved once a year. So, it's not on a weekly cycle in that sense. And so one of my concerns with research is I think it's become devalued. We're not balancing that efficiency triangle. We are focusing almost completely on speed and velocity. Very much it's deadlines, it's how fast can we push something out, and it's rarely about the customer's needs at all. And we aren't thinking about risk almost at all because there's no accountability. I've never seen someone in trouble for making a bad decision, even that we knew would be a bad decision. So, with no accountability, we don't care about risk and waste. And if we don't care about customer needs, then we're just going to try to be fast. And so, I think that while research is being devalued and misunderstood and changed in negative ways, I still don't agree with the things that the article said or suggested about it. But I think we do have to take a closer look at how our leaders and our teammates can empower research and researchers. If companies are saying, "Ah, this takes too long. We don't need it. Just run a survey. Just go out and ask a few people. Go ask three people what they want so I can prove that my idea is a good one." This is, you could call it research, but it's fake research. And we have to bring the value back, but the value comes with time and investment and quality. There's very few things in life that have high value and high quality when our biggest priority was how fast can we do it?
Anton also argues that that UX research has been focused on the wrong type of research, primarily middle range. How do you respond to his critique based on your own professional practice?
Yeah, so first of all, I didn't even agree with his categorizations. I thought they were kind of made up and kind of strange. I forgot to open up the article. So opening up the article quickly and trying to find those definitions, because the definitions didn't make sense to me. So first of all, in research, we generally bucket research as generative or evaluative. Either you're doing usually early research to understand behaviors, tasks. We like to roll out the graphic on the show that says people, contexts, and systems. You know, you're trying to understand people, find problems before solving them in a solution agnostic way. Evaluative research is more about we've got an idea, we've got a prototype, we've got a dev build or a live thing. You know, where could it be improved? Is it good? Those are usually the way that we bucket research. So he's got macro, middle range, and micro. He claims macro is strategic, business first, and future thinking. And my question is, when would you want your research to not be that? When would you want your research to not be strategic? For me, every piece of research I do is strategic. When is your research not business first? Well, it's hard because to me, I would say we've got to balance business with the user. If we always put the business first and the customer is an afterthought or out here in the periphery, we know it as the customer. We know you suck. We have to find the balance between what the business needs to create better strategies and decisions and initiatives with what the users and the customers need to feel like they're getting value. So I wouldn't say that it's business first, but we could say that it is business minded. So in that sense, my research is always business minded. I run exercises with my stakeholders, like my YouTube episode 196 on the knowledge quadrant, and we learn what do people need to know from this research to fill in the blanks, to replace opinions, guesses, and assumptions with evidence, data, and knowledge. What do we need to know to go in the right direction? And so when he says macro is strategic, business first, and future thinking, my question is, was it, when isn't your research that? And if it isn't that, what are you doing? Because to me, research should always be that. Good research is always that. He says middle range research is focused on user understanding and product development. Well, when isn't your research about user understanding? Maybe it's not about user understanding if it's market research. Maybe if we're trying to research a competitor or the technology that's out there in the universe or the technology that could be. Okay, that's not user focused. That's not user understanding. And that research has to be done as well. But when is your research work somehow not revolving in some way, ultimately, around the user? We've got to deliver this to the user. They've got to be in the conversation. So I don't see this differentiation. And then micro research, he says, is technical usability. Again, when wouldn't you want something that's usable? Eye tracking, which unfortunately has been debunked quite a lot. And also, we know that just because somebody looks at something, we don't know why they looked at it. We don't know if they looked at it and felt positively. So it's good. We don't know if they looked at it and they felt like this freaking sucks and we should change it. You know, just because someone looked at a thing doesn't mean we really understand whys and root causes. And then he says micro research is also detailed interaction development. And again, what does that mean? Because ultimately, your user and customer experiences are all made up of interactions, whether those interactions are digital or human. So I would say that these categorizations to me seem a bit, I don't want to be too insulting, but they seem a bit contrived. You know, to me, it felt like I was surprised I didn't see a trademark symbol, put it that way. I felt like somebody wants to create a model that they can put a trademark symbol on and say, you know, do this, not this. But ultimately, it was very hard for me to look at that and say, well, are you really saying, because in the end, he says, do less middle and more of the other two. And my thought was, are you really saying we should do less research to understand users, but that we're supposed to be delivering strategic research to help the business make decisions, but that we don't need to make decisions based on our users? And he literally says in the article, yep, we don't. We don't need to understand users in order to make products. Now that's true. But then we're the customers. So put yourself back in that spot. Think about a company that you had a bad experience with recently. Think about an app you uninstalled, a website you stopped going to, a SaaS system you canceled. Would user understanding have helped, have been important, have contributed strategically to the decisions we could have made. So I think that there's some things in his article that to me don't stand up well to critical thinking, because sure, we can say F the user. F the user, F user understanding. Let's just build crap, roll the dice, see what sticks to the wall. Sure, but how's that working for us? Because at the same time, we have people out there on podcasts and LinkedIn going, look at our high failure rates. We have high failure rates for our product launches. We have high failure rates for our A/B tests. And these were tests and experiments that we were highly confident in. We thought these were absolute winners, but we're getting a 92% failure rate. So I ask you, if we're failing that much, should we understand the user a little bit better? Strategically, I would say yes, that's risk and waste we can reduce. We'll never eliminate that risk and waste. We'll never get a 0% failure rate. But holy cats, we're failing a lot, and customers know you suck. And I think an article like this, again, you might say this is too aggressive a statement. Someone will say, Debbie's aggressive. And I say, okay, have fun. Everyone drink when someone says Debbie's aggressive. But I think that I felt like at the end of the article, I was supposed to hire him to come into my company and fix this. And then, of course, he has a website for his consulting where he's going to come in and fix this. But I ask you, would most UX researchers want what he's suggesting, which is supposedly business first strategic research that doesn't focus on user understanding? I'm not sure what user researcher wants to do. Whatever that is, and I'm not even sure what it is.
One of the things that the article suggests as well is that middle range research often falls into this weird bucket, and to translate specific and actionable recommendations, it fails to do that. How do you ensure that research overcomes this challenge?
I felt the article, and again, this is my opinion. People may disagree, and that's totally fine. I felt the article was full of a lot of gaslighting. I felt like the article said, like, hey, you did this middle range research and you couldn't tie your findings to actionable suggestions and you couldn't tie it to value. And my thought was, is anybody allowed to do that at their job right now? Is anybody given a reasonable amount of time to do good user understanding, let's call it middle research, where we can feed that information back into strategies and decisions and priorities? I'm not seeing that. And if that's not happening, it's not because our researchers broadly suck and everyone's magically getting this wrong. This guy's article makes it sound like you're all losers. You're all losers, and you did it to yourself. And I felt like it was just extremely unfair because it didn't take into account what's actually happening at companies, which is companies care about speed more than quality. And when they hire a researcher who wants to do some quality research and actually understand what people might need, they're told, we don't have time for that. That's not agile. Just run us a survey. We'll just do A/B tests. Well, then whose fault is it if the researcher is not delivering value or not seen as delivering value, or if the researcher is fighting to try to do the research that would deliver more value? It, based on the article, it sounds like that's your fault. You didn't deliver value. You couldn't take research and turn it into something valuable. And I've seen enough companies and spoken to enough people who are desperate to do any research that would show value, anything that isn't a fast survey, anything that isn't just another A/B test, anything that isn't a quick 3 to 5 person usability test. They're desperate to do something with depth and value, and they're blocked from it because someone says that takes too long, that's not agile. So I think that what he's saying, we can say, researchers aren't delivering enough value. As my article on this says, step one, are you allowing your researchers to deliver value? If you're blocking them or manipulating them or controlling them, or whatever the case may be, maybe they're not delivering value, but did you let them? I'm not going to blame them for the situation they're in. That's gaslighting. And so if this is true, you know, and then I also thought, Just because I put on my critical thinking hat. Those of you who watch my YouTube channel know the critical thinking hat. And so put on your critical thinking hat. And my thought was, here's this guy who spends all this time at the beginning of his article telling you what a great research leader he's been at famous companies. And my question was, did you do this? Did you create an environment in which researchers couldn't do research of quality? Do you have any hand in this? Now, I don't know. I'm not saying he did. I genuinely don't know. I only know that I'm a little surprised that a leader is blaming the worker bee. Where's the leaders? Where's the leadership in this? I look first at the leadership before I blame the worker bees for the situation they're in. So again, we can talk about the article if you like, but I think with critical thinking, a lot of stuff just kind of fell apart and felt like gaslighting to me.
I love like how you critiqued every single point of this and provided
Thanks.
A different perspective as well. Let's shift away a little bit from the article. What
Sure.
changes do you think are essential for the future of UX research?
Yeah, I think that as soon as we have any accountability at our companies, we'll see things change. Because right now, anybody or whoever, there's usually a product manager who says, I'm responsible for the product. I'm accountable for the product. And I always go, cool, what does that look like? And then there's crickets and there's, blank face and there's, does not compute. What do I say now? I say, how will you be held responsible? How will you be held accountable? Nobody knows. When's the last time somebody was held responsible or accountable? Nobody knows. Has anyone ever received a stern talking to? Has anyone ever been demoted? Has anyone had their budget cut? Has anyone received more oversight? Has anyone been fired? No. And so I think that for starters, we would have to see some accountability. We would have to be somebody saying, these high failure rates kind of suck. Our ability to win customers has been sucking. Our customer satisfaction scores or signals suck. Our ability to keep customers kind of sucks. What's going on here? Let's get to some root causes. Okay, now that we're looking at some root causes, maybe we'll start holding people accountable again. Maybe you can get in some trouble. I don't want people fired, but well, unless they do really bad things, but I maybe you can get in some trouble for doing things badly, for making bad decisions, especially informed bad decisions. So I think to me, I can talk about the future of research and what it should be, but there's only so much it will be while other people are controlling it. The company I'm working at now, I'm quite lucky. Loves research, freaking loves research, is hesitant to make a decision until I or another team comes back with data to prove it. I even said to them, here's our report. Please do this. Please shift away from this. They said, get us all of the whys. I sent one of my teammates to go watch 31 video hour long videos again. Find me all the whys. These people want to know. And I'm very lucky that I'm in a place where the decisions are really going to be driven by research. Not all of them. We'll guess at some stuff. I get it. It's not going to be, it's never the perfect world, and I don't expect it to be. But I've seen what an organization can look like when they say, you know what, before we do that, let's have Debbie talk to some of our target users and let's know more about that before we make that decision. So I can't get to what the future of research should be because research is freaking awesome as it is. The question is, will our teammates and leaders let us do good work? Or do they only want fast work? Because usually you can't get fast and good at the same time.
You have a podcast and you stream as well. What are the topics or the things that you focus on and how can your or listeners tune in?
So I've got two YouTube channels and been streaming and putting up videos mostly on the second one. And that one is called CX-CC, which I was just talking about before, is customer experience, customer centricity. And it's, again, it's really designed for everybody. Ta-da! Nice and subtle, right? So we've got the YouTube link for CX-CC. We also have a calendar of events because we do lots of free webinars. Almost all of our stuff is is free. So YouTube, check out our events calendar, cxcc.to/events. And then I do have a Patreon. The Patreon starts at $1 a month, or there's also a free tier. So these are some of the main ways to interact. And also I'm very active on LinkedIn, where I've got a newsletter there and I post to Medium. So, you know, lots of ways to run into my stuff. I'm sure if you just start Googling Delta CX or Debbie Levitt, stuff will come up. But yeah, mostly we're doing the live webinars, recording them, putting them up on the YouTube channel. Every Tuesday, usually, on the YouTube channel, I do Q&A AMA. So it's kind of like live mentoring for people. People can send in questions. You can even send in anonymous questions. So I get a lot of poop talking about people's jobs and like, help me with this ridiculous situation I'm in. So again, there's lots of things that I have put in place to try to give people completely free help. That I try to charge for as few things as possible. Yes, if you want to hire me, I take money for it. But in general, I try to make a lot of things available for free.
Debbie, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on the Same Logic Podcast today.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Get in touch.